I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon and founder of the Narayana Rudayalaya Hospital in Bangalore, India. The hospital provides cardiac care for the poor in India, and Dr. Shetty started the hospital in 2001. Welcome, Dr. Shetty.
Thank you very much, Jessica.
I'm speaking with you over the phone. You are currently in your home in India. Could you explain in your own words what Narayana Rudayalaya Hospital does?
The idea is to bring cardiac surgery to everyone. My country requires 2.5 million heart surgeries a year. And currently, we are all the heart hospitals in the country put together only doing about 90,000 heart surgeries. Jessica, first heart surgery was done 100 years ago. 100 years later, only 8% of the world's population can afford heart operation. Something has to be done. Narayana Hrudayalaya Heart Hospital has 1,000 beds, and we have 24 operation theaters. The infrastructure is currently performing about 30 major heart surgeries a day, but that is half of our capacity. And about 30% of our workload is on children coming from 65 countries for heart operation. And about 60% to 70% of the work is adult cardiac surgery.
What is the cost of open heart surgery to somebody who could afford it in India?
Approximately a heart operation on a child who can't afford to pay for the operation would cost about $1,400. The same operation in the U.S. might cost you around $200,000.
What are the primary factors in the business model of low-cost heart surgery? How are you managing to provide low-cost care to India's poor population?
First thing is you have to build a hospital differently. If you build a 100-bed, 200-bed hospital, you cannot reduce the cost. Because in a hospital, bulk of the cost goes for a hard infrastructure like blood bank, laboratories, CT scans, MRIs, PET scan. These are very, very expensive instruments. And what we do is we buy all these advanced machines, but we use them for 24 hours. To run it for 24 hours, you need a large number of outpatients. Large number of outpatients will come provided you are affordable. So first thing is we build hospitals in about 15 to 25 acres of land. And then we plan to build 5,000 beds, which we build in phases. So if you have large number of beds, then you do more operations. As you do more operations, your results get better. As your results get better, your cost also goes down. And because of these two reasons, more people will come to you.
What were you doing prior to opening the hospital?
I graduated from a medical college called Kasturba Medical College in Manipal, Mangalore in India. Then, like most Indian doctors, I went to England for training in cardiac surgery. Then I came back to Calcutta. I was one of the first few heart surgeons to come back to India to set up cardiac surgical unit. It was in 1989, where cardiac surgery was a mystery to most of my citizens. And when I started my career in Calcutta, if I saw 100 patients per day, not even one person could afford the heart operation. Then I realized that unless I take care of the ability to pay or the paying capacity of the patient, I wouldn't have a practice. So this is how everything started.
You conducted surgery on Mother Teresa. How was that a turning point for you, if at all?
Meeting Mother, as a scientist, I would never accept another human being with flesh and blood like me as God. But I can tell you that Mother was truly God in human form. Being with her, interacting with her, maybe as a heart surgeon treating her, it was a turning point in my career. Her simplicity, her approach towards the realities of life, it made a tremendous impact. And she gave me the fantastic definition of the definition for a pediatric cardiac surgeon. One day I was going for rounds and she was following me, even though she was an inpatient. She looked at the kids I operated. Then she looked at my eyes and she said, "Doc, I know why you're here." I said, why, mother, why am I here? He said, when God made these children with the heart disease, he was probably preoccupied. Then he realized there was a problem and he sent you to fix it. And that is the best definition one could give for a pediatric cardiac surgeon.
How religious were you prior to meeting Mother Teresa?
I was always religious, no, undoubtedly. I was born and brought up in a typical Hindu family down south, where religion is part of our life. But she reinforced my belief in God. She convinced me that the best way to serve God is by serving mankind. So I still have a poster of Mother Teresa in my office, which says, hands which help are better than the lips that pray.
And Narayana Rudayalaya, the name of your hospital, means God's compassionate home.
Essentially, in India, primarily we revolve our life around God and the cosmic forces. We wanted to create something unique, something big, which would make a difference to the society. Rudaya is heart. Alaya is temple.
We talk about Mother Teresa having this seminal impact on you, but was the train on the tracks to create this hospital even prior to your meeting her?
I think I was in the process of thinking about doing something different, something big. And this interaction with Mother, which lasted for close to 5 years, definitely had an impact on where I wanted to reach. Definitely it had a big impact in terms of looking after the underprivileged are the main concern and the pivotal role it had in building this institution.
My guest is the medical entrepreneur, Dr. Devi Shetty. Dr. Shetty is a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. He now provides heart care, eye care, orthopedic care, and cancer care to patients in India who cannot afford health care otherwise. Now, the institution or the hospital is in Bangalore, India, and Bangalore is known as sort of the Silicon Valley of India, where there's a lot of technical innovation. Why did you choose to locate the hospital in Bangalore? Was it accidental or was it purposeful?
My wife is from Bangalore. That is one of the main attractions to come back to Bangalore. But, you know, it's a coincidence that Bangalore happens to be the Silicon Valley and so many exciting developments are happening in Bangalore. That definitely helped our objective. But the decision to come back to Bangalore was coming back home.
You mentioned your wife, and it was your in-laws who funded the project. What did your mother or father-in-law do that enabled them to have enough capital to fund the hospital?
My father-in-law was running a very successful construction company, in fact, around 20 years ago. So towards the end of his professional life, he wanted to build a hospital to make a difference to the society. But he had only one condition, a condition that we should never refuse any child who comes to us with a heart disease, irrespective of caste, creed, and nationality. And this is something which he firmly believed, and he insisted that we do it. That's the only condition he had. And we carried on, and this is how the whole thing started.
It seems, Dr. Shetty, that there was this real kind of perfect intersection of Mother Teresa and your medical expertise and your father-in-law all coming together to create this hospital. Do you ever think about that, kind of the stars aligning?
You're right. I strongly believe in that, Jessica. I strongly believe in cosmic forces. Long, long ago, Jessica, I received a donation of 100,000 rupees from one of the army soldiers from Madras. He refused to give his name, and he wrote one note saying that the path you have chosen, the amount of money I am giving is too small. But God has his own mysterious ways of doing the rest. This is exactly what happened in my life. These are all strange coincidences at every level of my life. But I strongly believe that there is somebody up there with the proper design, which is a mystery to me. Mm-hmm. And that's what keeps happening all the time.
So you decide to launch this initiative in Bangalore. How did you get the land to build this vast health campus?
Our country is made up of 32 states, and these states have chief ministers and the government. And these governments are very supportive of hospital projects by people like us. So we get land virtually free, or we get land for a token amount of money, because government wants this type of large initiatives to come up.
Your hospital is performing roughly 7,000 surgeries a year, and often your doctors are being paid less than doctors elsewhere in the country. How is morale among your doctors?
We have zero attrition rate. No doctor has ever left us. I guess there is not even only one person left in the last 15 years for family reasons. Now, why people stick around, even though their salary is not up to the level what they can get elsewhere, is because as surgeons, if you want to attract them, they need much more than money. They want to do something else. And we always provide what they want, because I am one among them. Every day, children come to us. You know, typically a newborn baby who is very, very blue comes to you. We look at the kid. We tell the mother, baby requires operation. The baby goes to the OT, comes back to the ICU, and we call the mother to see the baby after 4 hours. Mother looks at the baby and say, look, this is not my child. Then we say, that is your child. Then the mother says, look, he was dark. He was black before you did the operation. Then we tell her that, yeah, he was dark, but now he's pink. Then she will touch the baby, and then she will look at our eyes and say, will he always remain like this? Then we say, yeah, he's going to remain like that. So in a matter of 5 hours, we have transformed the lives of these people. So this is something which you can never buy, irrespective of what money, you know, what you're prepared to trade.
You mentioned before that 30% of the surgeries that you conduct in your hospital is for babies or pediatric care. Why is it so high? Is it larger in India than in other countries?
Jessica, you remember, we produce 28 million babies a year. We produce the largest number of babies in the world. One out of 140 children born anywhere in the world has heart disease. That means technically we produce about 600 to 1,000 children a day with heart disease. And someone has to fix their heart, because these children, if they are operated the moment they are born or in the first few months of their life, you can cure them. So someone has to do it. So we are privileged to be that someone to fix these children's heart.
I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Devi Shetty, a medical entrepreneur who's creating a new healthcare economic model in India by providing affordable cardiac care for India's poor population. We'll hear more from Dr. Devi Shetty coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is the medical entrepreneur Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. Over 7,000 surgeries take place in his Nayararana Rudayalaya Hospital, located in Bangalore, India. Dr. Shetty founded the hospital in 2001. Now, you offer a form of insurance called Yashasvini. Can you talk a little bit about the germ of the idea for providing insurance?
The Karnataka Milk Federation, which is a conglomeration of milk producers, they requested me to sponsor one of their low-fat milk, claiming that it's good for the heart. And I agreed to endorse their product, provided the Milk Federation agrees to offer health insurance to the people who sell milk. So they agreed to do that. This is how we started the micro health insurance for the people, farmers who sell milk. And it started with a premium of 11 cents per month. We kept the premium at 11 cents because that is the price of local cigarette called BD they smoke. So the idea was to promote this concept that instead of smoking BD, you buy a health insurance and you will be protected for major illnesses. Today it has grown. This insurance has now spread to other states of the country. Everywhere, 60%, 80% of state population is covered by the health insurance.
So this health insurance that you offer started with this milk cooperative, essentially this group of farmers who, as you say, pay 11 cents a month for insurance. Can you talk a little bit about the rural poor? I mean, your hospital is in Bangalore, in a major city, but how are you addressing the needs of the rural poor who can't be transported to the hospital in time if they're having a heart attack, for example?
First thing is, when they develop heart attack, we look after their heart attack from remote areas, from the satellite. We have, you know, Jessica, there are 5 countries in the world which can put satellite on the space, and India is one of those countries. And we have been chosen to be partners with the Indian Space Research Organization to help them to monitor the astronauts when India eventually puts the man on the moon. And we have satellite connection free of cost. So we put up these satellite collection in remote government hospitals and manage heart attack and heart failure sitting in Bangalore or Calcutta. And till date, we have treated over 53,000 heart patients in remote locations.
Can you walk me through, let's say Devi the farmer is having a heart attack or is having some heart trouble. Can you walk me through what happens to him?
Yeah, let's put it this way. A farmer in Hubli, which is about 300 kilometers from Bangalore, if he develops a heart attack, he will go to a general practitioner with chest pain. And most general practitioners down south has a ECG machine, which is linked to the telephone line. And as soon as he does the ECG, it comes to our hospital. And in less than 5 minutes, we give the report to the telephone line. And if it is diagnosed as heart attack, we ask them to go to a coronary care unit in a government hospital or one of our satellite units over there. So the preliminary care is taken care of. That will save about 95% of the victims of heart attack. And after about 1 month, they will come to Bangalore for further evaluation. And there we do the angiogram and, if required, operation.
You mentioned the Indian Space Research Organization that helps you use satellites for this cardiac care. Whose idea was it to use this Space Research Organization?
The Indian Space Research Organization, they wanted us to help them in monitoring the vitals of astronauts. So we are helping them in their project, and they help us to give the satellite connections free of cost. Right now, sitting in Bangalore, we treat patients in 56 cities of Africa where our satellites are beamed. But the exciting thing, Jessica, I'll tell you, when we do liver transplants on children in Bangalore, do you know who gives the anesthesia for the kids? The anesthesia is given by Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in America.
Wait, so can you explain that to me, how a hospital in Philadelphia is helping you with a liver transplant in Bangalore?
We have extremely skilled surgeons who can do the liver transplant. But our anesthetists are cardiac anesthetists. They do not know the details about managing very sick child who is undergoing a liver transplant, where the operation lasts for 10 hours, 12 hours. So we tied up with Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. The anesthetists there, they realize that since we have the satellite link up, they can sit in the operating room of Philadelphia and manage the anesthesia of the kid who's undergoing operation in Bangalore. Other than touching, they can do everything.
So we talk about, Dr. Shetty, you're creating a health city, but it sounds, with this example of the connection with Philadelphia and also serving African patients, that essentially you're creating a health world.
Trying to, Jessica.
My guest is Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon and founder of the Narayana Rudayalaya Hospital in Bangalore, India. The hospital started off serving cardiac care for India's poor, and now its health centers help patients who have heart problems, eye problems, arthropedic issues, and cancer as well. Could you provide some anecdotes to help us understand what you do on a daily basis?
I start my work very early in the morning, generally, my colleagues start the surgery at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I reach the hospital by around 7:30. Then I have to see at least 70 to 100 patients every day in the outpatients. That's the time patients come, they talk to me about their problems, I console them, try to organize financial assistance. And essentially, it's like a meeting area for the patients. I spend about 5 hours with the patients. Then around 12 o'clock, I start the surgery. And I generally concentrate on operations called pulmonary endarterectomies or aneurysms. This is my area of interest. And sometimes I operate on newborn babies. Then as soon as I finish the operation, then maybe half an hour or an hour with my team discussing about various strategies and management issues. Then again the outpatient. And then it's around 9:30, 10 o'clock. That's the time to go home.
You mentioned you see 70 to 100 patients per day in a span of 5 hours?
Yes. I generally try to spend about 2 to 3 minutes with each patient. Everything has been done by my colleagues. The diagnosis is made, the planning was made, everything is done. But most of these people, unless I see them and unless I touch them, they wouldn't like to go for the operation. Mm. So it is essentially getting to know the family and explain to them that this is what we are planning to do. It is just reassurance that I am there to help them. I try to see at least in 5 minutes about two patients. Mm-hmm. I have a very big clock hung in front of the wall so that I'm constantly reminded. And I have a very fancy chair made by Herman Miller, which can move from one end of the table to the other end like a Ziffy. So I can turn my chair on and off and, you know, facing one patient, and the second minute I'm facing another patient.
Incidentally, was the Herman Miller chair donated?
That's a good question. It is actually gifted by my son. When he graduated, I guess he earned some money, and he was looking at me struggling with the old Indian chair where the wheels used to get stuck up. You see, what happens when I talk to a patient, the first 2 minutes is about talking to the patient, getting to, you know, convincing them about the treatment and all that. Then they are happy with the treatment. Then they start talking about, you know, I operated on their uncle or a father or a grandfather, how well he is or how grateful I am and all that. That's the time I try to move my chair to the other side of the table. Mm. And I need very good wheels. And my son realized that Herman Miller is the best chair.
So really what you're giving to these, you know, 100 patients is emotional consultation versus medical consultation.
Perfect. Yeah, you got it right, Jessica.
Do you worry at all that there's this kind of Walmartization of healthcare? In order for your hospital or for your low-cost health plan to work, you really have to serve many, many, many patients. You know, as you say, you're seeing 100 patients a day, you're doing 2 operations a day. This is obviously far more than the international average. Do you ever worry about the optics of that?
Not really. In the sense, see, there are a lot of changes happening in the country. Now, people, when they come to us, they're a lot more knowledgeable about what we are doing in the heart operation. So they have less questions. They are mentally prepared when they come. And also, my team is growing. So I'm surrounded by physician assistants and well-trained doctors. So essentially, I wouldn't say that as the workload goes up, we lose touch with the patients and the emotional aspect of it. I don't think it will happen. Mm. I think it's only getting better as the time passed by.
You talk about being at work around 7 in the morning and going home around 10 at night. What does your wife think about this?
She was finding it. She comes from a very rich family. So, she was initially a bit disappointed. But then, you know, as the family grew, now my children are grown up. My oldest son is an engineer. He's building all the hospitals. And my second son is a doctor, third son is in the medical school. She kind of likes my profession, even though she doesn't admit All along, she cursed my profession. But when my oldest son decided to become an engineer, and one day he declared that, "Daddy, I want to become an engineer." I said, "All right, that's good." Then she just, the hell broke loose. And I said, "What happened?" She said, "Why he doesn't want to become a doctor?" Then I said, "All along you have been cursing my profession, and you're disappointed your son doesn't want to become a doctor." That's the time I realized maybe my wife likes my profession.
My guest is the medical entrepreneur Dr. Devi Shetty. Dr. Shetty is a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. He now provides heart care, eye care, orthopedic care, and cancer care to patients in India who cannot afford health care otherwise. Dr. Shetty, your public health initiative has been quite successful against many odds. Could you talk about some of those odds or hurdles that you had to jump over in order to provide low-cost health care to the poor population in India?
When I started my career, the greatest difficulty was convincing people to undergo the operation. The heart surgery was in an infantile stage. Then once I accomplished it, the problem was the affordability.
You have this vision of having 30,000 beds in your health center. What are the hurdles to making that happen? Are they financial? Are they getting people's imaginations to understand what that means? What are those hurdles?
See, the first thing is we strongly believe that India will become the first country in the world to dissociate healthcare from affluence, healthcare from your bank balance. If there is one country in the world which can do it, that is India, because we produce the largest number of doctors, nurses, and medical technicians in the world. Mm-hmm. We have the largest number of US FDA-approved drug manufacturing units outside USA. We have everything required for a fantastic healthcare delivery system. But there is something which can prevent this from happening, that is lack of adequate beds. That is the reason why we want to create these 30,000 beds. Our biggest stumbling block now is arranging funds at our terms to roll out this many beds in a short duration of time without really losing control of the organization. This has been the challenge, because regular financial mechanisms will not be able to help us. So the challenge is raising equity, raising money for all this massive scale expansion.
What is your annual budget?
I guess around $100 to $120 million.
Per year. Yeah. It costs about $200,000 for a patient in the United States to have open heart surgery. And you are building a center or a hospital, a cardiac care center, in the Cayman Islands so that United States citizens and those nearby could benefit from a low-cost surgery. Why does it cost $200,000 in the U.S.?
I think in the U.S., the cost structure is radically different. You see, we work for 6 days in a week, whereas in the U.S., it's only 5 days in a week. Plus, your nurses and doctors generally work for 48 hours in a week, whereas we work virtually double the number of hours. So in U.S. hospitals, traditionally, 65% of the revenue goes for the salaries, while in Indian hospitals, it's about 20%. So essentially, the cost structure, the litigation, the malpractice suits, these are all issues which would jack up the price. And also, there is large insurance companies, you know, with their own, agenda. So essentially, it is a business where there are too many people with too many rigid rules and regulations, and there is absolutely no scope for innovation in the process of delivery. You just cannot innovate.
Hopefully, now that you'll be setting up a center in the Cayman Islands, some competition will cause the U.S. to get their butts in gear.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I don't think I would like to compete with the American hospitals. I just want to show our modest way of doing things.
You mentioned malpractice and lawsuits in the United States. How common are medical malpractice lawsuits in India?
It's extremely small. Primarily because as surgeons, we spend a lot of time with the patients before operation. We make things very clear to the family. So they don't have unrealistic expectations.
Doctor, you've changed so many people's lives. You've improved so many people's lives by providing low-cost cardiac care. Is there a story or two that come to your mind to demonstrate this?
See, essentially, I am like anybody else in the patient community because as a kid, I am the eighth child of a family with nine children. So when I grew up, my parents were old. My vivid memories about my father is an elderly person who goes in and out of the hospital because of diabetes complications. So in my life, doctors remained as very important people, and this may be one of the reasons why I decided to become a doctor. So when I interact with the patients, when I see a young lady with a young husband undergoing heart operation with young children, when I operate on them, I think about my life. In case my father had an operation, needed an operation when he was young, and if something happened to him, we would all be on the street. So, you know, these patients' lives are no different than our life. I guess this is one of the greatest motivating factors for all of us to do our best to save their life.
Well, Dr. Shetty, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica. It was a great experience talking to you because you are the first Western interviewer who could pronounce the name of my hospital.
My guest has been Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. Coming up, we'll meet Jordan Casalow, founder of Skojo Foundation, which supplies low-cost eyeglasses in developing countries. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Jordan Casalow, the co-founder of the Skojo Foundation, an organization that sells low-cost eyeglasses in developing countries such as India, Bangladesh, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Mexico. Jordan also co-founded Skojo Vision, LLC, a company that sells high-end reading glasses to stores like Neiman Marcus, Barney's, and Saks Fifth Avenue. And the company donates 5% of its sales to the Skojo Foundation. Jordan is also a practicing optometrist in New York City. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica.
I would love to know the first time you came into contact with this problem of people having limited access to eye care in developing countries.
The very first time I had this experience was as a student. I was an optometry student back in the early 80s at the New England College of Optometry. And there was an organization, a student organization called VOSH, Volunteer Optometric Services to Humanity. And we as an organization would go down to underserved communities in Latin America. My first visit was to a community in Merida, Mexico, in the Yucatan of Mexico. And there was a line of 2,000 people stretching almost as far as the eye could see, knowing that there was a team of American eye doctors coming to provide them with vision care. And for most of the people, it was the first time that they had access to vision care. My very first patient was a student from the School for the Blind. I started to look at the boy. He was about 7 years old. And I started to realize that something was a little bit strange. And I realized this was above my pay grade at the time. And so I called over one of my professors, and she came over, and she looked at the boy, and she looked back at me a couple times, kind of with a confounded look in her face. And she finally looked up, and she said, "Jordan, this child isn't blind. This child just has profound nearsightedness." So he effectively could not see beyond an inch or two beyond his nose, literally. And there we went. We looked into our library of glasses that were cataloged by Power. And sure enough, there was a pair that almost perfectly matched this boy's prescription. And so I was the lucky one who got to sit in front of the boy and actually bring the glasses to his face for the first time. And as I got a few inches away from his face, his countenance completely changed, that of a sort of a blank stare of a blind person to an animated face of a seven-year-old boy, and he just came alive right in front of my eyes. It was a very powerful moment. It was a moment that certainly changed the course of his life as it did mine.
This inability to see close up really impedes one's ability to work. What are some examples of your enabling somebody to see and therefore changing their economic possibilities?
Well, I'll answer that question in a second, but just to give you a sense of what I kept experiencing was that for each person, every person who had these terrible, profound blinding diseases, there were 50 people who were coming to us because they couldn't see up close to work and to read their Bibles. And so it was kind of antithetical to my public health training to say to someone who has river blindness, please come in, we have this pill Mectizan to give to you, but tell 50 other people, sorry, we don't do that here. And I kept seeing that pattern over and over, and no one was doing anything about it. We've seen countless individuals who have lost their economic lives because they can't see to work. Most people in the developing parts of the world will earn their livelihoods with their hands, and so they need to see up close. And the cruel joke is that after the age of 40, 45, after 20 years of mastering their crafts as weavers and tailors and artisans, they lose their ability to focus, and as their vision fades, so does their income.
What's an example of somebody's life you've changed because you've given them glasses?
One is of a woman in Latin America who came to us, and her chief complaint was that she was a very deeply religious individual who was 52 years old, and she brought her Bible, and she was complaining that she hadn't been able to read her Bible for 10 years. After a quick exam, a minute later, we put a pair of plus 250 reading glasses on. She put them on, and she could see the Bible again. And as soon as she saw that, she hit the floor, she hugged my legs, and she started to cry, and it was just a very moving moment. The next day, we came back to see some more people, and she was the first person online. And I thought, when I saw her, uh-oh, something's wrong. And then I realized she got up at like 4 in the morning to be the first person online. And she brought 17 chickens with her to provide me with a gift of chickens because I had changed her life. She said, for you, there may be just a pair of glasses, but for me, you gave me back my God. And
wow.
So those kinds of profound experiences. Other ones that have to do with work, we met a goldsmith in southern India. And as the night hits in India, the lighting is very poor, and he couldn't work in the evening. And during the wedding season in India, you have to work hard all through the night to keep up with the demand for gold and the rings that he needed to make and earrings and so forth. And so his vision faded, and his income over the course of the year was about half of what it was the year before because he couldn't work pretty much at night. One of his friends became one of our vision entrepreneurs, and he heard about it, and he got an exam, and our vision entrepreneur sold the glasses to him, and it happened right before wedding season again, and he was able to then work through the night, and he basically doubled his income back to where he was.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is a social entrepreneur, Jordan Casalo, who founded Skojo Foundation, a nonprofit organization that sells low-cost eyeglasses in developing countries. He's also started Skojo Vision LLC, which is a company that sells high-end glasses to fancy stores like Neiman Marcus and Saks Fifth Avenue, and you donate a percent of the revenue to the Skojo Foundation. Now, why do you sell your glasses to the people in the developing world rather than give your glasses? Why is there this emphasis on market-based mechanism?
We've seen too often development programs that utilize a humanitarian approach and are almost like a relief approach, whereby market-based mechanisms will often solve the problem more effectively. So there are situations in the world with Hurricane Katrina and such, where you need a humanitarian relief kind of approach to solve a problem. There are other conditions, like the need for reading glasses, that is not a huge catastrophe that just happens once and you need to pour dollars and resources into it. It's a low-lying problem. There's 700 million people who need it. And frankly, there aren't enough donation dollars in the world that are going to go to a cause like that. But there is a product. Our glasses we sell in the developing world for between $2 and $5, so it's affordable to most everyone except for the very, very poorest, and we do make exceptions. And so we just felt that market mechanisms were a much more powerful way to get this product to the market and to the people who needed it.
What are some of the problems that you're facing in the developing world? Are people buying them? No problem?
People are definitely buying them. I wouldn't say no problem. On the consumer side, when we first started this, we thought that this was going to be largely a distribution challenge, getting the product from point A to point B. And indeed, that's part of the problem. But as much of the problem is that it's really more of a market creation problem. In the poorest reaches of the world is a very fatalistic attitude that when my eyes fade, they fade. And when my hair turns gray, my hair turns gray. And just when things happen, that's just the way it's supposed to be. And not like here where if something doesn't work, you say, well, how can I fix it? Also, then when people are aware that this is an eye problem, then they think of glasses as a medical device, not as a consumer product. When people who do have glasses, the few that end up not working over time, they say the medicine has run out of my lenses. And they have that sort of approach, that thought process where this is a medical device and how could this be sold by someone locally who is just like me. So one of the big shifts that we're trying to achieve in the markets is changing the medical model to a consumer product model. And that's very much what happened here in the United States, that 20, 30 years ago, ready-made reading glasses were not available. They were not legal to sell in pharmacies and Walmarts and stuff and in places like that. And so some smart entrepreneurs started to kind of create a fact and start to sell them over the counter. And there was a large, big legal battle between the eye doctors and the consumer rights advocates. The eye doctors lost, and now reading glasses you can find everywhere.
Now, because you are selling these glasses to these people, are you giving them choice of, let's say, red glasses or blue, or are there aesthetic choices as well in the purchasing process?
We do have aesthetic choices and price point choices. We believe strongly that the consumers at the base of the pyramid are about as savvy a value-conscious consumer as you can find. These people do not part with their money easily because they don't come to their money easily. We've also realized that vanity is not monopolized by the rich. A great story to that effect occurred years ago when I was in Colombia. And we had this woman who came in. She had had cataract surgery, and they didn't put an implant in, and they didn't give her what they call aphakic glasses, which basically rendered her as blind as she was before she had her cataract surgery. And so she came to us, and she needed a very strong pair of glasses. And sure enough, we had one that was almost identical to what she needed. And it was a 1950s cat-eye pair of glasses on a woman from the Choco Indians. And we thought it looked cute, but the next day she came back and she returned them. And we didn't know why she returned them. And we finally got to the fact through the translator that when she got back to the village, people laughed at her and she looked funny. And so we've learned our lesson many times over that you just can't pawn products onto people who are living in the poorest reaches of the world. They too require products of quality, and they have to look a certain way.
I want to talk about the logistics of Skojo's distribution process a little more, because you empower a lot of women entrepreneurs in these countries. Why are you partnering with women to sell your glasses?
Well, the reason behind taking this approach very much was borrowed from what Muhammad Yunus and his work at the Grameen Bank and other people who are working in microfinance have explored and understood. Women, when they have access to capital, tend to invest it in their children, and they tend to invest it in health and education. Whereas when men have access to capital, unfortunately, less virtuous things occur, and the dollars often go to things like beer and radio. The other thing that they've learned was that women have for many years in these societies been charged with the task of making very little money go a very far way. So we've chosen women because of those two primary reasons. Now, does that create challenges? It does in some societies. We have found in all of the countries where we work that in each country there have been stories of problems with the men sort of getting in the way of the women's success. We found it probably the most profound in India, where it's gotten to a point where almost we have to couple the women entrepreneur with their husband or someone in their community because it's really not socially acceptable for women to travel from village to village.
What are some other issues, aside from women being unable to travel by themselves, that are impeding them sometimes? I mean, is there any jealousy among the men that, hey, you know, these women are getting more money, they're earning more money or income than I am? Or is there any resentment that they're deviating from this social fabric?
Absolutely. We've had a number of our women, one of our most successful entrepreneurs in India, in fact, had to close her business down because her father just couldn't accept the fact that his daughter was outperforming him economically. We've had many husbands who've done the same with their wives. The other thing that happens with when women have access to capital is that the power structure in the family changes. And so women start to have more say of if and when they're going to have children. And
thank goodness.
thank goodness. So again, these are sort of the virtuous cycle of development that occurs, that when you give women access to opportunity and capital, positive things happen. There are also many men that we've encountered who see the merit in it, and they love the fact that their wives are doubling the household income, and they've seen the benefit.
Do you ever feel the compulsion to intervene? Like in this case, when your most successful female entrepreneur in India has to stop the business because her husband doesn't approve, is there anything that you feel you can do there, or you just say, okay, well, that's the situation?
Yeah, that goes beyond the mandate and dictate of our organization. However, we do, as part of our Vision Entrepreneur training, we do in Latin America provide women empowerment seminars and self-esteem seminars as part of our entrepreneurial training. So indirectly, we arm the women with some fuel to fight back, if you will.
You mentioned before Muhammad Yunus, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for his microfinance efforts with the Grameen Bank. And now there's this concept called microfranchise. Can you describe this microfranchise model?
We're not satisfied with selling a few glasses in a few places. So we started to look at how to take our blueprint and start to scale it and start to sell it to other organizations that could use our model. For instance, BRAC is the world's largest non-governmental organization based in Bangladesh, and they have almost a community health worker in every village in Bangladesh. These are women who have taken out microcredit loans from BRAC and started small businesses selling health products. We said, well, why can't we just take that infrastructure and add to their basket of goods one other really important product, which is reading glasses?
The concept of social entrepreneurship is really still a young one, and you are unique in that you are partnering your Skojo nonprofit foundation with the Skojo for-profit company here in the U.S. Can you explain that dichotomy a little bit?
Sure. I have a family of three. I grew up in an upper middle class background, and I realized that life is expensive. And so I wanted to be able to provide for my family the same things that my parents provided for me, which is a great education and a safe and good place to live. And even though it sounds simple, that's pretty expensive these days to have. At the same time, I saw the power of the skills that I was acquiring at school, and I realized early on that that part of my professional work was critical to the development of my person and my soul. And it was really going to be part of my legacy as a person on this planet.
So simultaneous with a profit motive, you also have the social cause.
Yes. And each one feeds the other. The for-profit, as we mentioned, Skojo Vision LLC will provide 5% of their profits, our profits, to the foundation. And the foundation, because it's an intriguing story, gets a lot of attention and provides the company with some wonderful press and public relations.
So how did Skojo get its first donation and from whom?
The from whom is the philanthropist, businessman George Soros. And the story is, at the time, I was the health fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And Mr. Soros was doing an event at his home in New York to try to raise awareness about AIDS and all the issues around AIDS. And I was one of the first guests there. And I got into his wonderful, beautiful home. And there he was with one other person. And I was literally the second guest. And he turned to me. He said, well, what are you doing? Skojo was on my mind to really start to do, and I said, well, do I give him, tell him what I really do, or do I what I want to do? And I said, quickly, well, I'm here from the Council on Foreign Relations, but what I really am interested in is the fact that there are millions of people who are losing their economic lives because they can't see to work, and we have a very simple solution. It's just a simple pair of ready-made reading glasses. And he looked at me, he goes, that's a fantastic idea. And I said, I'm glad you think so. I think so too. And he said, you know what? And this was literally after the elevator pitch. He goes, I'd like to give $50,000 to that idea and tell Stuart Papran, who's one of his top executives at his foundation at the Open Society Institute, that I want to give $50,000 to this cause in Nigeria. So the next day I call Mr. Papran, who I don't know. And I say, hi, Mr. Papran. My name is Dr. Jordan Casalo. I don't quite know how to tell you this, but Mr. Soros told me to tell you to give me $50,000. And he says, hold on. So wait a minute. Come on in and let's talk. And we spoke. He said, I do really like the idea. I see why Mr. Soros was interested, but I would love to try this in India.
How much did that incident give you fire to actually pursue it?
It was instrumental, but frankly, I would have done it either way, but it certainly didn't hurt the momentum.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Jordan Casalo, co-founder of Skojo Foundation and Skojo Vision LLC. You could check out their website at skojofoundation.org or skojo.com. If you'd like to listen to the show online, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com. If you have questions about the show or an endeavor you're trying to get off the ground, please email us at talk@fromscratchradio.com. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.